Good evening and welcome. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. Thank you for coming out on a nice Monday evening. I can actually say that the weather outside cooperated with us. We've had quite a season of dealing with bad weather here at the library, but I'm glad we have a good crowd for tonight. I would like to ask you that if you have one of these devices, a cell phone, an iPad, anything that's going to ring or make a noise, please just take it out and silence it for the next hour. We'd really appreciate it. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are here with us tonight, and they do have books for sale, and they'll be available after, and our presenters will be available to sign. It's my pleasure now to welcome a very loyal library member, Carrie Lochtenberg, who is going to do our introduction for this evening's presentation. Carrie?
Good evening, everyone. It seems extraordinary that our beloved New York Society Library would be hosting a lecture given by library members Shireen Blair-Brysack and Karl Meyer to discuss their latest intriguing book, The China Collectors, at the very same time that New York City is in the throes of what is known as Asia Week. Christie's, Sotheby's, Bonhams and Doyle's are collectively staging 22 auctions over this period. At Christie's, the estate of Robert Ellsworth is up for sale. It is a massive and important collection of Asian art and antiquities. The catalogue of his collection comprises six volumes containing 8,320 lots. Also, more than 40 dealers are exhibiting Asian works of art, along with several institutions holding lectures. Actually, a stroll in this neighbourhood along Madison Avenue in the 70s and 80s speaks for itself. And by the way, as this incredible world of ours turns, word has it that the Chinese have descended upon the city in droves, driven to repurchase their patrimony. So, if one subscribes to the adage that there are no such things as coincidences, the timing of this lecture is a perfect and apt example. And should it be needed, it is further evidence that our library really has its finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist. The China Collectors has been lauded by a combined group of esteemed reviewers and publications from both sides of the pond as a journey every bit as thrilling and surprising as the expeditions that fill its pages. Or, this page-turner is the creme de la creme of archaeological adventuring. Or as essential reading for anyone, cognoscente and dilettante alike, so forth and so on. Amongst many other accomplishments, Shireen Blair-Brysack is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, an acclaimed author, and a lecturer. Her husband, Karl Meyer, was a longtime foreign correspondent at the Washington Post and the New York Times, editor of the World Policy Journal, and is a prolific writer, having published 14 books. He has lectured at Yale and Princeton, where he earned his PhD. Besides their broad individual range of artistic, professional, and literary achievements, Shireen and Karl have co-authored Tournament of Shadows and Kingmakers and another book. And this shared journey has brought them to their most recent collaborative destination regarding China and America. This, their latest book, its own variation on the theme of what, in my humble opinion, is a veritable treasure trove of a read in and of itself, providing thought-provoking insights, observations, anecdotes, and swashbuckling tales to boot. To quote, if I may, from the final paragraph of the final chapter of The China Collectors. And what possessed Dr. Arthur Sackler? As the French aphorist La Bruyère said of collecting, it is not a pastime but a passion, and often so violent that it is inferior to love and ambition only in the pettiness of its aims. Or, adds the British connoisseur, Kenneth Clark, why do men and women collect? As well as ask why they fall in love, the reasons are irrational, the motives as mixed. In the end, however elusive the source of these out-of-body affairs, museums all over the world are filled with their progeny. Who or what has the superior moral claim to their possession is a matter we, as in Shireen and Karl, discuss in our epilogue. Without wanting to sound too Pollyanna-ish, one can only hope that what is described in the epilogue to The China Collectors is a dream that can be converted into reality. Shireen and Carl certainly make a convincing case for it. I ask you to join me as fellow travellers in welcoming the authors as we embark on an adventure through time with them as our guides to learn more in depth about the fascinating cast of characters of early collectors of Asian art in America, some of whom no doubt inspired and influenced the man whose collection is on the block this week.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming. It's delightful to see so many familiar faces in the crowd. For those of you who've heard us talk here before, Carl is usually the speaker. He is the more experienced public speaker. But in this case, I am the one with the hand-eye coordination, and there are 46 slides. So that's why I'm doing it tonight. So please bear with me. I've been a member of the New York Society Library for 40 years, and as my dowry, I gave Carl a membership, so we go back a long time. Now, and I must say they have an excellent collection of Chinese art books, including, if you want to know, the complete catalog of the Nelson Atkins Gallery or the Met or what exhibitions they have, I really recommend upstairs on the 12th floor. We really use the library, as usual, for our books. Now, couple of terms I want to explain that I'm going to use, which may not be familiar to you who do not know about Chinese history or particularly about Chinese art. One is the Qing Dynasty. Now, the Qing Dynasty came to power in 1644. The Qing are the Manchus. They invaded from the north, took over what was the Han Chinese Empire, the Ming. And it ended, for those of you who've seen the Bernardo Bertolucci movie, The Last Emperor, with Puyi, 1911-1912. That was the end of the Qing Dynasty. Another word I'm going to use is bodhisattva. Now, a bodhisattva is a spiritual being that's on the way to Buddhahood, but remains behind to help those of us on earth do better. You often see bodhisattvas. They're very popular in China. The most popular bodhisattva in China, in Japan, is the Buddha of compassion, the bodhisattva of compassion, Kuan Yin, also known as Avalokitesvara in Sanskrit. And if you were watching the earlier spin of the slides, that wonderful seated figure against the painted background, that's in the Nelson Gallery, it's in Kansas City. That is the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin. Okay, now I'm going to start off by answering a question that people always ask us at the end. So the question is always, how do you choose the subjects for your book? How did you happen to pick this topic? Well, the one good sentence summary of the book is that it was hatched in a Harvard archive, ripened at Oxford, and came of age in a two-year encounter with a host of patient scholars and curators. The seed was planted in our 1997 book, Tournament of Shadows, which was about the great game in Central Asia, the rivalry between the British and the Russians for domination of Central Asia. And one of the characters in that book was Sir Oral Stein, a Hungarian, who is responsible for a large collection of artifacts from Dunhuang, which are now housed in the British Museum. While there was a very curious thing that happened with Sir Oral Stein, he made three very successful journeys to Dunhuang, and then the fourth expedition, which he did for Harvard, was a total disaster. And his two biographers, neither one of them dealt with that fourth expedition. But we were at Dunhuang, and we were talking with our guide, Tao Wang, who's now the head of the Chinese department at Sotheby's. And we said, well, what happened with this fourth expedition? And he said, well, no one knows. There's nothing left of it. So we were curious, and we wrote about that in Tournament of Shadow, the fourth expedition. But while I was looking at those files, the files were in 13 boxes of Langdon Warner's files. There was one set of files, and Sickman was in the same box as Stein. And I knew who Lawrence Sickman was. He was the director of the Kansas City Museum, the greatest collector or curator of his generation of Chinese art. And I started reading this file, and it was very, very unusual, and it was very, very frank. It was really like Langdon Warner saying, go back and steal the drapery. And you'd never leave this sort of thing behind. And we always remembered that, and when it came time to do a book, we needed a project because we were invited to be fellows at Oxford. But they said, you have to do something while you're here. So we thought about that, and we said, let's look and see if there's enough there for a book. And there was. So this is how this book started, and I'm going to start with the beginning of Long Men. This is the file that I found. This is a picture of Long Men. I'm going to show you a picture here of Lawrence Sickman in Luoyang, which is the city that's right next to Long Men. Now, Sickman had just begun his shopping trip for the newly founded and handsomely endowed Nelson Gallery in Kansas City. Now, Long Men's artworks were scattered among some 2,000 unguarded caves and grottos. Local peasants, aided by photographs of the sites from dealers, were stealing to order, and the cave's treasures were already on offer in the back rooms of the Lily Chang. This was the antiquities market of Beijing. So what would Larry do? The freewheeling and engaging Langdon Warner faced similar moral dilemmas on his own earlier trips to China. His considered advice was direct and urgent. Go for it. Initially, the Fogg offered to share expenses with the Nelson Gallery, which in due course acquired the Empress Frieze. This is the Empress Frieze. Now you can see, this is the Empress. You can see her, which is a lotus crown. And this is her, the subsidiary Empress. So that's why it's called the Empress Frieze. Now, this is now in Kansas City, dates to 522 AD, and depicts a procession of donors led by this empress. Now, it was assembled in Kansas City from myriads of pieces, heads, bits of drapery, some of it fake, as it turned out, and took many months of labor in a sandbox to assemble it. Now, the matching relief, which you can see in the Metropolitan Museum, is the Emperor Frieze. And there is the Emperor. Now, looking closely, this is in the first room as you go into the Metropolitan. It's huge. It's 9 feet long. It's on your right. There's some problems with this. You see the gaps here? And you see these very odd-looking heads. Well, part of those heads were in Kansas City, and there was a long correspondence that we found between Alan Priest and Sickman about these heads, and finally Alan Priest, the Metz curator, brought the heads, put them on. But they don't look too good, all of them. I mean, Priest thought some of them might be faked as well. There's, missing gaps. You'll see it's really not in such great shape. Now, I want to quote from Lawrence Sickman, who wrote this in 1967. The work, The Empress Frieze, is rather like a person who has suffered a very serious accident. The skill of the facial surgeon may make him recognizable to his friends, but he's never quite the same. All who are concerned with the cultural traditions of China would far rather wish that the relief of the Empress were still in far-off Honan province, an integral part of the Binyang cave for which it was made. Sherman Lee, Sickman's great friend, an expert on Asian art, and the director of the Cleveland Museum once remarked, "When a curator comes back and says he's discovered an important work of art, he really means a dealer discovered it." Enter C.T. Liu. This is the great villain of the piece. Oh, I'm sorry. This slide shows you in situ. This is how this guardian lion looked in Long Men, and this is how it looks now in Boston's Museum of Fine Art. Then there's a matching one in Kansas City. So you can see what happened there. Okay. Here is C.T. Liu, the great villain. He was the foremost dealer of his time in Chinese sculpture. He was to have a long and mutually profitable relationship with America's curators and collectors. Thus, Liu is viewed by the Chinese as the chief culprit of the West plundering of Chinese art. According to his French biographer, Liu was born in an obscure silk-producing village outside Huzhou to an opium-addicted father and a mother who committed suicide. Liu traveled to Paris as a cook on a boat arriving in 1902. There, he went into business partnering with the commercial attaché of the Chinese embassy to found Tong Ying and Company, which besides trading in tea and silk as a sideline, also dealt in Chinese antiquities. But the shrewdest investment was to use their profits following the 1911 revolution that overthrew the Qing dynasty to fund Sun Yat-sen's nationalists. They were able to use this leverage with what became Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government and to ship artifacts abroad, despite a 1913 prohibition on exporting antiquities. Initially, Liu found his inventory in Europe, but in 1911, he opened offices in Peking and Shanghai, which made it possible for him to obtain a number of important objects, many with an imperial provenance. Early on, Liu sold Ming and Qing ceramics to European collectors like Sir Percival David, whose remarkable collection is now in the British Museum. But as World War I raged, Liu broadened his horizons and turned toward the Americans. Clients like John D. Rockefeller Jr., Charles Lang Freer, Grenville Winthrop, Albert Pillsbury, and Eugene and Agnes Meyer, the owners of the Washington Post. Liu's European clients preferred ceramics, jades, portable objects. They were not interested in Liu's photographs of Long Men. They weren't interested in Buddhist sculpture. Liu then came up with the idea to sell these large sculptural pieces to America's millionaires. The larger the object, Liu would claim, the more difficult it was to export, and thus the rarity should command the highest prices. One of his early sales was to the Pennsylvania Museum. These are very large. They're 5 feet tall, so you can see. They represent two horses of the Emperor Taizong. The one on the left is called Adamdu. The one on the right is called Curly. Obviously, these are Penn's names. They're not the Chinese names for them. They're from a set of six from the Emperor's mausoleum near Xi'an. Now, how did Liu manage to get these out of China? The horses were still in place when the French scholar Edward Chavannes saw them and photographed them in 1909. The current registrar at Penn Museum, Dr. Zhou, whose research we relied on for this chapter, found a letter from a French dealer, Paul Mallon, in their archives, who wrote that he had dispatched some thieves to carry them away. However, the robbers were attacked by peasants, and the thieves threw them down a precipice. There they remained until 1913. They were next transported to the provincial governor's office, and he and the military commander were trying to endear themselves with Yuan Shikai, who was then the president of China. This is by this time the dynasty had been overthrown. And so they thought they'd give them to him for a present, and he would put them in his garden. Okay, so they got to Beijing, and there Liu negotiated with the family of Yuan Shikai. Here, in a minute I'll give you a pic. That's Yuan Shikai. He was president of China, and eventually for 3 months he was emperor. And that was, then he died, and that was the sort of end of him. Any rate, Lu got these two large pieces of sculpture, shipped them to the United States. They were they were sort of stored in the Met. You could see them. But he was negotiating with Penn, and Penn, he shipped them on consignment to Penn, and it took them some time to raise the money to buy them, but in 1921, they finally raised $125,000 for the two, and that's what they paid for them, and that's where they are now. They're in the Penn Museum. Now, at the end of this dynasty, the Qing dynasty, the Chinese were really abandoning Buddhism. They weren't really very interested in it. They were kind of going back to Confucian, to Taoist values. But Americans were enthralled with Buddhism. Americans like Henry Adams and John Lafarge were discovering it in response to a newspaper man's inquiry about why the pair, Lafarge and Henry Adams, headed to Japan in 1986. Adams quipped, "To seek nirvana." To which the journalist replied, "It's out of season." Isabel Stewart Gardner's new museum in Boston sported a Buddhist room, and Abby Rockefeller and her sister Lucy Aldrich were also developing an interest in the religion. So Lu thus found a ready clientele for his growing collection of Buddhist sculpture, and he shifted his focus to America by opening a gallery on Fifth Avenue in New York. But at the same time, in 1926, he made the audacious move of renovating a 19th century townhouse, turning it into a five-story red pagoda. It's still there, it's still red, it's on the Rue de Courcel, and it's still a gallery, although it has new owners. The family sold it off, so it no longer belongs in the family. I want to show you now his New York gallery. This is his gallery on West 57th Street in 1950, by which time Mr. Lu had retired and had turned it over, the gallery over to Frank Caro. Now, the other people are quite interesting in her picture. This is Prince Ashwin Lippe, who is advising the Met on Chinese painting. And this man over here was Alan Priest. We'll meet him again. He was the longest-serving curator of Chinese Asian art. He was there from about 1928 until the 60s, when he was forced into retirement. So I want to just sum up and just show you what a few things that Lu sold to the Metropolitan, although in the first case, this hand, Buddha, which is again in the first room as you go into the Met, he gave that to the Met. Now, maybe you'll recognize this Lohan. This is one of eight. There are two in the Met. Eight went west. One of them was destroyed in the war in Berlin. There's one in Canada. There's one in Boston. And there was originally a set of 12. Now there are only seven that we know of. Okay, and then this sort of, maybe some of you will recognize this. This is 50 feet long. It's in the first room of the Met. And again, you say, how on earth did they get that out of China? Well, it turns out that the monks of this particular temple were interested in renovating the temple, and in order to do that, they needed to raise some money, so they sold off the paintings. Now, the painting was bought by Mr. Lu, shipped in 30 pieces to America. Arthur M. Sackler eventually bought it and gave it to the Met, so there we are. Now, the Chinese considered Lu the arch-villain of all the dealers, curators, and collectors because, naturally, he was Chinese. The other people were not Chinese, so how could a Chinese do this to their own native country? Well, he saw himself as a kind of ambassador between East and West. In 1940, he wrote, "China has lost its treasures, but our only consolation is, as art has no frontiers, these sculptures going forth into the world, admired by scholars as well as the public, may do more good for China than any living ambassador. Our monuments may be preserved even better in other countries. than in China. That was often been used for years as a justification. Things are better preserved in the West than they are in China. So when did America's engagement with China begin? Pan-Pacific Link has an old history, or at least old by American standards. For a practical reason, during the 1780s, when our infant republic was officially neutral, our mercantile ships were trapped in the crossfire of Franco-British wars. Yankee sea captains were continuously harassed by the Royal Navy, which seized hundreds of vessels, confiscated their cargoes, and subjected their crews to forced recruitment. Small wonder that Americans began seeking markets elsewhere. Hence the rejoicing in New York Harbor on May 11, 1785, when the good ship Empress of China, seen here just at that time, became the first American mercantile vessel to reach the Far East, completing a 15-month trip and logging some 32,000 miles. As the newspaper, the Pennsylvania Packet, commented, the ship's ample and lucrative cargo, tea, silks, porcelains, jewelry, and dishware, presaged a happier era, quote, of our being able to dispense with that burdensome and unnecessary traffic we have carried on with Europe, to the great prejudice of our rising empire and future prospects of solid greatness. Hence the comparable rejoicing 2 years later, when another fully loaded vessel, the Grand Turk, returned to Salem, Massachusetts, becoming the first ship from New England to trade directly with China. So lucrative was the China trade that in the year 1800, Salem, Massachusetts had become per capita America's wealthiest city, while Elias Haskett Derby, the trade's financial godfather, is commonly reckoned as the nation's first millionaire. Actually, in present-day terms, he would be a billionaire. In the words of Samuel Eliot Morison, the leading chronicler of America's maritime history, the years 1783 to 1860 formed that magic era when America first became a world power, when Salem boys were more at home in Canton than in New York. Out of that commerce came America's first formal treaty. America's first formal treaty, negotiated in 1845 by Caleb Cushing, a congressman from Massachusetts, an event duly celebrated by an exhibition in Boston called the Great Chinese Museum, which attracted thousands of spellbound visitors, among them a teenage poet, Emily Dickinson. Thus, newborn America's improbable relationship with ancient China was off and running. Its origins in Salem are fittingly honored in the Peabody Museum by this punch bowl, presented by the officers of the Grand Turk and inscribed at Canton, 1786. Yet another fundamental anchor date for this evolving cultural tryst was 1870, the year in which Boston's Museum of Fine Arts and New York's Metropolitan Museum were both founded. Thus, at the outset of America's Gilded Age, there materialized inviting and empty museums in cities, nurturing a financial and industrial elite whose members frequently dwelled in instant castles with empty salons. Soon enough, an eager flotilla of art dealers materialized, typified by the House of Duveen, whose best-known partner, Sir Joseph Duveen, reputedly never saw a niche he didn't want to fill. And a final critical element in this combination was a bonus that especially appealed to self-made millionaires and their heirs. The treasures of Asia were dollar for dollar by far the best buy in the emerging golden global fine arts market, a reality shrewdly appreciated by the Freers, the Walters of Baltimore, the Morgans, and the Rockefellers. Now it's time to introduce you to some of our characters. First is William Woodville Rockhill, probably the most able scholar diplomat of his age, a 6'4" redhead Born in Philadelphia and raised in France, he became fascinated by Tibet while a student at the Sorbonne. After attending Saint-Cyr, the military academy, and serving in the French Foreign Legion, he returned to America, married, then managed a ranch in New Mexico while pursuing his Asian studies. Thanks to his wife's chance inheritance, he was able to take a modestly paid diplomatic post in China. There he became the first American to reach Tibet and befriend a Dalai Lama, the 13th. We're now on the 14th Dalai Lama. Meanwhile, he collected 6,000 objects and 1,000 rare books, now in the Smithsonian Institution and the Library of Congress. Now, that's a Tonka on the left, now in the Library of Congress, that the 13th Dalai Lama gave to Rockhill. Now, it must be said, Rockhill never reached Lhasa. So he met the Dalai Lama in the Wutai Shan, which is a temple in China, because what had happened in 1903-4, France's young husband led an expedition to Tibet and conquered or captured Lhasa, occupied Lhasa, and the Dalai Lama had to flee to China. And he enlisted the help of Rockhill. And so he gave him this gift and some other gifts. And Rockhill did always have a sort of soft spot for Tibet. The incredible thing is that Rockhill did take these two trips to Tibet. Many, many miles. He was walking most of the way. But the incredible thing to me was that here this guy is redheaded and 6'4", and he's dressing himself as a Mongol, and he thinks he can really sneak in. And of course they catch him each time and they send him back. They say, sorry, you can't go to Lhasa. And but that was where he was. Did I just lose something here? Yeah, I did. What came unplugged here. Sorry about that. Okay, there we go. Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. Rockhill opened the door for a procession of future collectors, which was only fitting because he was the author of the famous open door policy. Now, we have up here is Charles Lang Freer, who was a fastidious bachelor, born poor and self-taught, a serious collector who left his mark in a name museum on the Washington Mall. In a triple sense, Freer owed his success to the railroads, which were to the Gilded Age what the internet is to ours. Freer's fortune came from Detroit-based American Car and Foundry Company. By 1900, the foremost manufacturer of railway cars. He became a serious collector first of American art, notably the works of James McNeill Whistler. You may have seen in the initial slides the famous room at the Freer with all of the Whistler room with all of those, the blue and white china. That was one of the early slides. he started with Whistler and then proceeded to collect Asian art. And the railways also enabled him to travel in China. And here is the Hotel des Wagons-Lits. This was the terminus hotel for what was the Trans-Siberian Railway, the China Spur. Now, the Trans-Siberian was finished a little late for Freer because his last trip to China was made in 1911. There, his trip to Longmen. We talked about lawmen before. He didn't travel lightly. He made a lot of photographs. He didn't take anything. So that was his trip. And one of the quotes I always like is from Agnes Meyer, the wife of the Washington Post owner, and who was a very close friend of Freer and who left a lot of the Meyers left a lot of their collection to the Freer. And she said, this is a quote from her, that Freer had a particular love for his jades. When desperately ill at the end of his life, he would cling to certain pieces of jade with deep satisfaction and with an almost religious faith in its comforting and restorative powers. I must say, I forgot to mention when we looked at the picture of the hotel, he would stay at that hotel, but then he would rent a warehouse because he didn't want the dealers to see how rich he was. So they would come to these poor kind of rundown warehouses, and that was where he dealt with them. Freer benefited all art-loving Americans by persuading the Smithsonians to establish on the Mall the very first federally financed museum wholly devoted to the arts. Opening in 1923, 5 years after its donor's death, the Freer Gallery of Art served as a precedent for the National Galleries and four other siblings on the Mall, one of them being Washington's second Museum of Asian Art, welded architecturally to the Freer, donated by another self-made millionaire, Arthur M. Sackler. In our pages, we also honor an undeservedly forgotten imperial viceroy in China who tutored visiting collectors like Freer. His name was Duong Phong, and he was a frustrated reformer during the final years of the doomed Manchu dynasty. In 1905, he visited America and its museums as one of the five commissioners on a global tour. This is Duong Phong. Now, these are all of his objects. We have a better view of this that he brought along. They traveled from San Francisco to Chicago to New York and to Washington. And he met people like Freer. He met various people that were interested in Chinese art, including the guy who's on our cover. So this is the picture of that tour. One of the interesting things for those of you who are interested in things Chinese were these badges that the Mandarins all wore. If you had animals, that meant you were a civilian officer. If you had these are all civilians, so you can't really see those. But those show that you're a Mandarin. You've passed all these Mandarin exams. This Duong Phong helped to find the key genres of Chinese art through his own meticulous catalogs. And in the troubled spring of 1911, he was named Director General of China's Railways. As one observer wrote, he was the prince of officials, famous for his tact and ability. But alas, during that regime-changing year, foreign mastery of new rails lines stirred riots, and when Duong Phong took command of an imperial force to quell protest, he was beheaded by his own troops. A decade later, the Metropolitan Museum managed to purchase that set, and it still holds pride of place in their collection. There's a question of what, supposedly this was all found together, and it's the only existing one where you see it all together. There has been some questions raised as if he maybe added a couple pieces or not. But it is absolutely beautiful when you see all the various forms there of the altarpiece. Now we come to one of our very favorite characters, the swashbuckling Langdon Warner, who was supposedly one of the models for Indiana Jones. Now, Warner, along with Sir Oral Stein, whose finds are in the British Museum, and Francis Paul Paleo, whose gleanings from three expeditions to Deng Huang were the basis of the Musée Guimet in Paris, he is regarded as another one of these foreign devils. Harvard funded these three expeditions to Deng Huang in Gansu province in eastern China. Two were led by Warner, the third by Stein. Warner's hall included 12 paintings and this bodhisattva. You can see it. It came out of the cave. They're all in front of the cave. Now you can see it as it looks like, sort of fixed up, restored, and in the fog. Now he also took 12 wall paintings, but those are a really tragic story because only two of them really could be exhibited at all. What happened was he... The fresco removing techniques were fairly primitive, but what he used was a technique that had been applied in Europe on frescoes. But he took these barrels of glue, and they froze. They were very cold, and it was put on very thickly on the walls. And these are not really frescoes. In other words, the wall is not prepared first, and then they paint them. These are just painted directly on the walls. So when he removed them, and put them in these mappas. The mappa is sort of these three-wheel carts, and got them back to Beijing and finally to the fog. They were disintegrated. So you go to Deng Wang, and the guides will tell you exactly what happened to these big holes in the wall, that this was taken by Langdon Warner, Fog Museum, all that. And actually, if you want to have some fun sometime, if you figure out the Chinese characters, which you can do to Langdon Warner, and you put in the Chinese characters in Google, and then you run it through Google Translate, the Chinese to English, you can see all the really terrible things the Chinese say about Langdon Warner. In the interest of restoring Warner's reputation, his family has requested that they return these objects to Deng Wang, but the fog, citing the fact that Warner had a signed receipt from the caretaker of the cave, they have declined to return them. Now we come to another Bostonian, another Brahmin. This is Denman Ross in a charcoal drawing by Sargent. He was a Brahmin bachelor and Harvard professor who used the proceeds of his father's lucrative real estate and business ventures to fund his purchases of art. My motive was a love of order and sense of beauty. The collecting of art was simply incidental, he wrote. I had the money to spend, so I spent it. When friends came to visit, I found myself saying the same things about the same objects and telling the same stories over and over again until I was ashamed of myself. I could not go on like that, so I gave my collection to the MFA, first as a loan, then as a gift. Probably his single greatest gift to the MFA was this 17-foot-long scroll entitled The 13 Emperors Scroll. This is a Tang Dynasty, at least that's what the MFA says it is. Most books say it's a Tang Dynasty original. Another scholar has said maybe it's Northern Song a little later. But at any rate, it's a very beautiful piece, and it shows 13 emperors. This happens to be the Emperor Wu Di of the Han. And you can see this online if you go to the University of Chicago. It has a wonderful website, and you put in 13 emperors, and they will rotate the scroll for you. They do that on a lot of famous scrolls, so you can just kind of watch it go by, see all 17 feet of it. A third collector in our Harvard triptych is Grenville Winthrop, an eccentric lawyer who wintered in a New York townhouse a block from the Metropolitan Museum. His blood was properly blue. Grenville was a direct descendant of John Winthrop, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and the Winthrop crest proudly adorned his New York home. Like other Harvard bred collectors, he was spellbound by Charles Eliot Norton, a pioneering lecturer on art. After a brief business career and his wife's early death, leaving him with two young daughters to care for, Winthrop devoted himself to collecting art. Now, he raised his daughters at home privately as they gravitated between New York and his estate in Lenox, Massachusetts, where he was great friends with Edith Wharton. Now, his mansion, and you see him in the garden here, there was a mansion, there were 40 gardeners, and 500 peacocks and pheasants. Then the story takes a Downton Abbey twist. While he was in Manhattan, his housebound daughters eloped, one with a family chauffeur and the other with a staff electrician. That was in 1923. As a Harvard article relates, shocked, abandoned, alone, Winthrop turned entirely to art. On his death in 1943, he bequeathed his entire collection to Harvard, 4,000 objects spanning time and place, but especially rich in rare Chinese jades and bronzes. It is deemed the largest single gift of its kind to any American university. I particularly like that jade and gold belt buckle. It's really a masterpiece of art. Now we finally turn to Abbey and John Rockefeller. Now, this is Abbey next to one of the prized possessions of John Dee. He was the collector of porcelains And he particularly liked Famille Noire, which is that. This is, again, Qing Dynasty porcelains. And Abby kind of looking rather vase-like herself. Now, Abby was the daughter of Senator Nelson Aldrich. And her marriage in 1901 to John Jr. in Warwick, Rhode Island, was the year's most publicized match. John Jr. was the only son and primary heir of the industrial titan, who was said to be the world's richest person. She was the daughter of the acknowledged Republican boss of the Senate, Nelson Aldrich. Bride and groom both had a lifelong interest in fine arts, and Senator Aldrich provided what might be termed a lawmaker's dowry. As chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, he propelled the passage of the 1909 Payne-Aldrich Tariff Act that, among its provisions, eliminated duties on all works of art more than a century old. Well, you can imagine what happened. And one of the first persons to take advantage of that... Sorry about that. Okay, I must just hit it here. Okay, was J.P. Morgan, and that's a famous cartoon by Kepler, and you can see he's sitting in America drawing all these things from the rest of the world with his magnet. Now, he shipped from Europe 351 cases to the Metropolitan Museum, of which he was then president. And among the financier's special passions were Chinese porcelains. His bested choices filled an entire gallery in the Met. When Morgan died in 1913, the porcelains passed to his son Jack, who chose to put the entire collection on the market. None of them were left to the Met. They stored them for all this time, but they didn't get them. Now, John D. Rockefeller Jr. was wholly taken by porcelains and sought from his father a $1 million loan to skim off the best of the Morgan collection, which Duveen had purchased with the idea of reselling it. Now, this is part, I quote from the letter from John Jr. to his father, John Sr. "I have never squandered money on horses, yachts, automobiles, or other foolish extravagance," the son wrote to the father. "A fondness for these porcelains is my only hobby, the only thing on which I have cared to spend money." After a few more exchanges, Senior relented and presented Junior with $2 million worth of securities as a gift, not a loan. Among the many works later given to the Metropolitan is this appropriate image. This is the god of wealth. In his warlike aspect. For her part, Abby's tastes were more adventurous some than Junior's. Tellingly, she led the way to the creation of the Museum of Modern Art, Museum of Folk Art, and the modern art was on a site adjacent to the Rockefeller apartment, which was on 54th Street that age. Now, this is the drawing room, and you can see a lot of those porcelains and how they were exhibited. This piece is now in the Metropolitan as well. He had great fondness for these vases. And, you know, they had five kids, and I never understood how they could keep the stuff from being broken. I mean, we're talking serious money. You know, they were selling for $30,000, $40,000 in 1920s money. So you're not, you know, kids banging into them? Evidently not. It seemed not to have been a problem. Now, Abby, they had a place in Seal Harbor. And she was always looking for garden stuff and all. And one of the things that she came upon while she was looking for garden furniture was this white marble statue, again, of a bodhisattva. You see the draperies, the jewelry, it's a bodhisattva. Okay, this is supposedly Tang Dynasty. It was bought from Yamanaka. Now, there was a problem with this. She liked it. Her husband didn't like it. Why didn't he like it? As he wrote the dealer, didn't have any arms. It didn't have a head. And Junior protested, "I never enjoyed a mutilated statue." But she prevailed, and it's now considered one of the great highlights of their collection. It's now in Kaikut, if anyone goes and sees it. Now, the Duke scholar Stanley Abbott has suggested it is probably a fake. Now, why? Maybe this looks a little bit Greek. Looks a little bit like it might have been created for people that were really interested in Greek art at the time. It's got a kind of Gothic sway. It's large and marble, not typically. There are other marble statues, but it's not really very typical. So at any rate, it might not be. One other picture I'd like you to show. This is the famous exhibition in 1935-36 at Burlington House, in London. And this was the sort of exhibition where the Chinese sent things. Every collector, every museum, with the exception of the MFA, because Denman Ross didn't believe in loaning anything, so he was the leading trustee and they didn't lend anything. But you see here, you see what they sent to the Royal, this is the Royal Academy in London. This is your Tang horse. That was sent by Penn. And this is the Bodhisattva, which was sent by the Rockefellers. So you can see that it was thought of very highly in its day. Now we come to our favorite character, George Cates. Nobody's ever heard of George Cates. He wasn't a famous curator. He wasn't a famous dealer. But he was thought by his mentors, including Paul Sachs at Harvard, he was expected to become the Bernard Berenson of Chinese art. Didn't happen. Everything presaged well. He graduated summa cum laude from Harvard. Then he won every prize, every recommendation. He won a fellowship to go to Oxford. He got a doctorate from Oxford in Renaissance art. He made a detour to Hollywood. And on the steps of Harvard Library, the then president of Harvard introduced him to the head of Paramount Pictures. And the head of Paramount Pictures said, "Hey, we need a guy who can advise us on costumes, you know, hardware, on doors." They were doing a lot of French films at that time. We're talking about Paramount. And so he advised on costumes for Pola Negra. He coached Jeanette McDonald in French. He wrote the most wonderful letters that are now at Harvard and in the Smithsonian about his adventures in Hollywood. Then the Depression came and he lost his job. And so in 1932, he writes Paul Sachs, his mentor at Harvard, who taught the famous museum course at Harvard and trained all the museum curators. Paul Sachs is a very big figure in the book. Okay, he says, "I'm off to China." And Paul Sachs can't quite figure this out. Here's this guy with a doctorate in French history, and he's taught at Harvard in French history, and he's suddenly off to China. Well, he goes to China, and at one point, he wrote an absolute treasure of a book called The Years That Were Fat, a copy of which is in the New York Society Library, of the original version, the 1955 Harper's version. Okay, now, before I leave this slide, he very briefly was the curator of Brooklyn Museum from 46 to 47, and he had an exhibition of his own furniture. This is all Ming furniture that was there. Now, this guy really loved Ming furniture. Nobody else was interested in Ming furniture at that time. He shipped all his own furniture back to America when 1939, when the Japanese invaded and all. He got the furniture out. He did go back to China in the 40s as a member of the OSS. Now, okay, moving on. This picture does not show George Cates, but it shows everybody else living in China who was anything at the time. Now, this is Harold Acton's birthday party. I don't know whether you know Harold Acton. This is Harold Acton. Harold Acton was the model for Anthony Blanche in Brideshead Revisited. He lived in China. His villa, the Villa La Pietra, is now owned by NYU, and it's their Center for Renaissance Studies in Florence. He went native to a certain extent. He brought a very lavish house that had belonged to George Morrison, who was the correspondent for the Times of London for many years during the last days of the Qing dynasty. And George Morrison had this huge kind of house, And so he hacked and bought the house, installed a swimming pool and an English lawn. And now, in this picture, the other interesting thing, this is Larry Sickman, curator by then of the Nelson, Kansas City. And this is Alan Priest, curator of the Met Museum. George Cates was there at the time. He was a friend of all of them, but he just doesn't happen to be in the picture. Now, we come to Robert Ellsworth, who Carrie mentioned. Now, this, on Wednesday, this Wednesday, 2 days from now, March 18th, the Ming furniture collected by Robert Ellsworth, who is commonly known as the King of the Ming, beautiful, beautiful furniture, lots of it. He was the foremost dealer in recent time. It'll all go on the block at Christie's as part of a 5-day sale. Ellsworth bought from George Cates. George Cates had to sell everything in 1955 at Park Burnett. And I went and looked at the Met catalog the other day, and there's one thing in the sale, this ice chest that was in the 1955 sale at Park Burnett. It went for $425 and is now estimated to go on Wednesday between $7,000 and $9,000. That's the only thing I could find that was still left over from Elsa's purchase from George Cates. All these stories confirm the fickleness of taste, the volatility of the market, and the changing ethical rules in the China art trade. So what of the road ahead? Will the market in Chinese art continue to go? Probably. Given the insatiable thirst of collectors coupled with the exponential increase in Chinese cultural tourism. At the Metropolitan Museum, Chinese tourists are the fastest growing segment of the Met's global audience. In mainland China, meanwhile, there is an unprecedented boom in the construction of new museums. This is a museum in Nanjing designed by the New York architectural firm of Stephen Hall and Associates. As you can see, many of the new buildings are very cutting-edge, designed by prominent architects, and commonly set in the heart of newly enlarged or created cities. Instead of being built around cathedrals, as in Europe, or churches, as in New England, new urban spaces in China are built around these museums by developers. Only problem is most of them are empty. They don't have stuff to put in them. So that brings us to the next part of our story, which is their 15-year campaign to bring back artworks to China. Now, the campaign's first round occurred in the year 2000 in Hong Kong when Sotheby's and Christie's jointly sponsored an imperial sale that featured three bronze animal heads that once adorned a zodiac fountain in the Yuan Ming Yuan, or the Garden of Perfect Brightness. Now, these are the 12 statues right here. Now, all that's left of them are the heads, and the heads sort of spewed water. That's where the fountains came. This was about a dozen miles from Beijing, and Chinese citizens of all persuasions have long concurred in denouncing as war crime the sacking of portable treasures from the vast 100-acre palace grounds, and most especially the demolition of the celebrated fountain, which was designated in an ironic twist, designed by an Italian Jesuit missionary, Mr. Castiglione, who for many years was a resident at the Manchu court. Now, here are two of the three heads that were on sale in 2000, the ox and the monkey. These were pillaged in 1860 at the end of the Second Opium War by British and French armies. They were ordered to destroy all these quarters, all these buildings in the summer palaces in the final battle. The order was given by the 8th Earl of Elgin, who happened to be the son of the Lord Elgin who took the Parthenon marbles. Thus, an uproar ensued in Hong Kong when the sale of the bronze heads were announced. Beijing officially called for the withdrawal of the disputed art from the sale. Hong Kong residents, otherwise critical of the People's Republic, joined in clamorous protests. Stop auction, return Chinese relics to motherland. To no avail. Sotheby's and Christie's pointed out that the same heads had been sold at previous auctions without provoking protest. Then Beijing unveiled a novel weapon. It authorized the China Poly Group, a marketing offshoot of the People's Liberation Army, to submit the winning bids. The monkey and ox fetched more than $2 million at Christie's, and the tiger went for $1.8 million at Sotheby's. All three bronze heads arrived triumphantly in Beijing, where they immediately were exhibited in the new Poly Art Museum. In a long sequel to the Zodiac Tale, a bronze rabbit and a rat went on the block in 2009 in a Christie's sale of the Pierre Bourget Saint Laurent collection. But this time, the winning bid was cast by a Chinese millionaire who then refused to pay, arguing that the two bronzes were stolen properly. Finally, after prolonged litigation as a goodwill gesture, the corporate owners of the auction house presented the rabbit and the rat to China as a gift on the occasion of a state visit to China by President Hollande. So where do we go now? Well, there's a great recycling program, such as the Ellsworth sale this week at Christie's, perhaps the last great opportunity to buy from the collection of a great dealer. Then there are loan shows, such as the Great Forbidden City show at the Toronto's Royal Ontario Museum. This was last summer. The youngest and oldest of leading powers are certain to have many political and economic differences, but in the field of gold and art, mutual fascination and affirmative engagement prevails. May it continue to do so in Asia weeks to come. Thanks very much. Now, I'd like Carl to join me because he's going to answer some questions. If there are, we'll be happy to take some questions. Anyone have any questions?
I'd just like to say your talk was witty, insightful, meaty, and timely. It just couldn't be better.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We should stop while we're ahead.
But I tell you, I have cards with photographing the cover of our book with some comments on the back that any of you want to take it, or we also have books for sale.
Yeah, there's some books for sale, but how about the questions? Anybody? Yes. Well, he's a wonderful letter writer, and there are hundreds of letters. And he was really, really in love with China. He wasn't in it for, he never intended to sell anything. He really wasn't a dealer. He lived as Chinese. I mean, he didn't put in bathrooms. He didn't do any of that thing. He had a couple. So he really went very much native. And everybody seems to like him who's read the book. There's a sort of soft spot. He was kind of a loser in a way. I think he was a small winner. I don't view him as a loser. But he had a very, his life peaked in China. And he lived to be a very old man. He died broke in an old age home in his 90s in Rhode Island. And he had a problem. Three problems. The first of the problem was he was a China hand. And if those of you who know what a China hand was, Robert Service, Owen Latimer, all these people, well, he was in China during that period working in the OSS. And those people were blamed for losing China. So he was a China hand. That was a problem. He was Jewish, which was a problem in those days. And he was gay, most likely. So those were three strikes against him at that particular period. And he never really got a job after Brooklyn. He would get lots of grants. He had fellowships, you know, grants, all this sort of thing. And he really wrote a lot of sort of, did a lot of scholarly work. But he just, and people didn't, he had a lot of rich friends, but nobody seemed to really help him out. So that's why it was kind of a sad story. He went off and he lived in Innsbruck for a while because it was cheaper to live in Europe, but then came back, as I say, and died in New York. Yes, back in the corner there.
Could you talk a little bit about the 1913 legislation
You do that, Carl. That's your...
Well, this was the...
Yeah, Carl, to the mic here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Join me over here. Thank you, sir.
This was the Payne-Aldrich bill. Aldrich being...
No, she's talking about the Chinese export law, 1913.
Oh, the Chinese export law. Sorry. China has had a series of laws on preservation of their antiquities and so on, starting with the 1913. An even stronger law was passed in 1930. And then when the People's Republic came in, they have had several laws that have come in. But there's a great difference between having a law and enforcing it. And the problem in China is that large parts of the country are either under local warlords, is an accurate description, or have been for much of the 20th century, or there were bandits and thieves and unscrupulous. And you had the building of the railroads. When you build the railroads, you tunnel right through these tombs. So all these things were disrupting the landscape of China at the very moment that there was a demand for art. So that the laws, while good in spirit, were null and void in practice. That changed with the Maoist ascent in 1949, changed to a degree. It's still, there is a considerable, as we quote various Chinese archaeologists themselves saying, if you want to get rich, says a peasant saying is, find a tomb and open it. So there's still a problem very much. That's an interesting story. It varied. The Cultural Revolution, among its targets, were old things. The four olds, one of them is old culture. But it varied much from different cities. In Shanghai, for example, the museums formed a conspiracy to frustrate the Red Guards that were going around and sacking things. And they made private deals and preserved a lot of their places. In other places, they didn't... that when you go to Dunhuang, for example, and see the caves, a lot of it was destroyed or vandalized during the Cultural Revolution. But I think, you know, something that we ought to think about, that now that there's a big issue in Syria and Iraq about the destruction of ancient things and historical things, and we rub our hands and say how awful and how barbaric. But first of all, in China in 1860, when Elgin ordered the destruction of the Summer Palace, he was destroying, he was like, as if someone had invaded France and then leveled Versailles and all of its buildings around, and did it as a punitive gesture that they were going to punish it. So we cannot be morally superior as Westerners about what happens in this respect, that we have something to apologize to think about as well. And I think the same goes for what happened during Maoist times. Yes, there were excesses, but also those excesses bred the reaction of wanting to save it. And miraculously, one thing that happened that was very important was in 1971, I think it was, a peasant near the ancient capital of Xi'an came upon a terracotta soldier. And then they suddenly found there was this huge army, 5,000 figures, that was the afterlife bodyguard of the emperor, whose name was Qin, and who gave his name, in fact, to China. This created a sensation all over the world, and it helped change the Chinese attitude towards their own past as something that they wanted to preserve.
I just want to add something. One of the things that happened was that Ming furniture is very easy to take apart. And a lot of people just disassembled their furniture and hid it under their their floors and things like that. So some of it survived because they did go after furniture, and anybody that looked like they had nice stuff was a target. Yes?
What is the moral story here? Do we have any moral standing at all? Even where we pay for it, isn't
This is a former colleague of mine, Jack McKenzie. Jack, I think the most interesting and morally impressive figure was Charles Lang Freer. He was very troubled by what was going on, and he sent, of all people, Langdon Warner on a two-year mission to go to China to see if he could persuade the Chinese to cooperate with his funding to establish a national museum, a training place for archaeologists, to protect the sites, all of those things. The problem was that it was 1913, 1914, and the report that he made urging all of these things coincided with the outbreak of the First World War, and it was all moot at that point. Nothing could be done. So that there were Americans, in fact, many Americans, who were morally troubled by this and have come up with different responses and different ways of doing it. Having said that, I think this is not just an American problem, it's a European problem, the passion of a collector, the pressures of politicians to either create something that looks great or to punish someone, all of these are part of this drama that we write about.
Yes, so you haven't had a chance yet.
And Narl, yes. He was very modest about this. It was during World War II, and he sent a memo to either the White House or the Pentagon on the targets in Japan, and he specifies that these were historic cities, et cetera. But he later on very modestly said that he wasn't responsible. Nevertheless, in Japan, he was regarded as a hero. Just to add a footnote to that, we talk about the monument men in Europe. There are also monument men in Japan, and these included
Sherman Lee, Larry
Langdon Sidney. Warner. So they were all monument men. That was part of the training of a post-war generation.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think, are you talking about C.C. Wang and people like that?
No,
the man, well, the paintings were usually sold. Now, there's a question, Puyi, the last emperor. There was a question when the Qing dynasty fell. Did those artworks belong to the family, the Isengoro family, or did they belong to the nation? And there was a sort of treaty drawn up that they were supposed to give them to the family, but it was never really established. The eunuchs were stealing like mad. So some of them, a lot of things disappeared and right after the aftermath of the fall. However, Puyi and his brother were sneaking stuff out during the time they were still in the imperial palace before they moved down to Tianjin moved into, you know, became friendly with the Japanese and all of that. So actually, Sikbin bought some things. Various people bought things from Puyi. So then there were just a lot of collectors of Chinese paintings who'd been collecting them over years, and those people were legitimate owners, and they were sold. Now, the paintings are really not so much a matter of being looted, not unlike, say, the bronzes, where people were digging them out of the earth. There was, we talk about him, William White, who was an Anglican bishop in that area. And
Canadian.
Canadian, later headed the Royal Ontario Museum. And the peasants were delivering stuff right to the door of the rectory. So that's where a lot of the bronzes come from, the Anyang region. So, but the paintings were kind of portable and were owned by people, and the people had titles to them. That's not to say, I mean, there's, of course, the big controversy between Taiwan and Beijing about the stuff that was taken to Taiwan at the end of the war by the nationalists. And so Beijing thinks that those belong in Beijing.
There's a special Chinese twist to this issue, too, because there's a long tradition of making copies of paintings. And very often they are presented as if they were the originals. And the fear of getting buying a fake is one of the things that has haunted the whole Chinese art market in a degree that's not true anywhere else.
One of the reasons for the Chinese flocking to America for this auction at Ellsworth is the whole issue of provenance, because there's so many fakes in China. And at least you know if you're buying from the Ellsworth collection, you can trace it back that it wasn't his collection. He believed it was an original. And in some cases, like in the case of that George Cates ice chest, he bought it. It can be traced back. It was here before 1960. Which is usually, is it 1960 that's the cutoff date?
Yes.
Yeah, when you're supposed to be able to trace provenance back to 1960, before 1960, otherwise it could be looted. And that goes for, you know, Italian art, pre-Columbian art.
This is one of a dozen or more memoranda of understanding with different countries that the State Department has been negotiating in the last 20, 30 years that provides ethical and legal guidelines for the export and preservation of antiquities.
Let me get one back here, and then I'll come to you.
Yeah.
Why 1960?
This is always a problem of finding a cutoff date on when something becomes legal or illegal, and different legislation and different measures have put different years to it. But I think this is just a problem of reaching a consensus on what's logical and can be enforced and what cannot be.
Yes.
You mentioned Abbey Old Rich Rockefeller. Are there any other and the other questions? Ellsworth. Is he regarded now as a controversial figure or not?
He's rather beloved. I mean, everyone speaks rather highly about him. I don't know of a controversy about him. He's given a lot of money to China, I mean millions, to restore houses, villages, whatever. And I suspect a lot of the loot from this sale, this is a huge sale, it's going to bring in, you know, millions of dollars. Probably that is, some of that is earmarked to help the Chinese. He has a foundation. Now, what was the other question?
Women,
yes. Lucy Calhoun. Lucy Calhoun was the wife of the American ambassadors in about 1910. She fell in love with China. Her husband died in about 1909. They came back to Illinois, where he was from. And she went back to China and lived there. She bought a hutong, a kind of a temple, that she reconstructed. I mean, she installed plumbing and things like that, unlike George Cates. And she was kind of the great doyenne of the foreign colony in China. Now, she collected she got a budget from the Chicago Art Museum, and she bought a lot of textiles, which there are in Chicago. The ladies that were in Beijing in the 20s and 30s were really into collecting robes and textiles, some of which they wore, some of which they altered, some of which are now in museums. Textiles and jewelry were their things, not so much Buddhist sculpture. Another person was Kate Buckingham, also this, she really doesn't figure large in our, I mean, there were a lot of people we had to leave out. Alfred Pillsbury, great collector of bronzes, we had to leave him out, huge collection in Minneapolis. But Kate Buckingham was really very important. She left everything in the name of her sister. I can't remember the sister's name, but in Chicago. And there's really a wonderful collection of bronzes and dingware. I don't know if you know Northern Sung pottery and all that. It's really, really beautiful stuff. And you know, the fact that she was collecting this stuff in the early 20s and all, people didn't start to really appreciate that ware until very recently. But yes, there were a number of also smaller collectors, And we do handle, we do talk about them in the museum. There were not a great number until recently of women curators, because that was a very hard, you know, it's very hard to break in curatorial work until very recently.
Why don't you meet our friend Nancy in the house?
Well, now there are. You know, Nancy Berliner at the Museum of Fine Arts, Daisy Wong at Penn, Eleanor Pearlstein at Chicago, Nancy Steinhardt at Penn. There are lots of them now, probably as many as there are men, but this is a really recent development.
But let me just say that we're trying to find some way to bookend our book. We begin with Salem, and I think that we found a good bookend at the other end with Nancy Berliner, who was a curator for the Salem Museum, the Peabody Essex Museum, or PEM. And she was wandering in the backwoods of China, and she came upon a fabulous 5 or 6 century old merchant's house, and it had a for sale sign on it. So she thought, well, maybe she could raise the money to buy it. So she first cleared the local authorities that it would be possible to do it, and the family that owned it, and she made a deal that her museum would buy it, and they would dismantle it and relocate it in Salem, Massachusetts, and that a team of Chinese workmen, we're talking about 2001, 2 or 3, would come over and reassemble it there. So now when you go to the PEM Museum, one of the star attractions is Yinyu Tang, the name of the house, where when you go there, you have one of those things you put up in your, and it takes you through the room. And each room, they tell you, this is where the family did such and such. This was a special room for dealing with spectral issues. And it's an absolutely fascinating thing. And this was done without any controversy one way or another, and I think was emblematic of the kind of collaboration that I hope will be possible in the future.
Mark says we have time for one more question. Okay, yes.
I have what I think would be a common thing for you to discuss, and that is that the collectors that you told us about had a passion, had money to collect, and they weren't afraid because Chinese art was new to America in the early 1900s. Did they have any other common traits that you can come up with?
Chinese art was cheap. You know, when you read all the papers, I mean, we did a lot of archival research for this book, you realize the characteristics of these people. I mean, Morgan didn't bargain. He was going to pay whatever it was plus 10%, you know, whatever they bought. He didn't really care. He didn't really bargain. But John D. Rockefeller, I mean, he was so afraid of being taken. And everything had to be perfect. You know, he had to have arms. It couldn't be cracked. Broken, chipped, and he had to be able to return it if he didn't like it. You found some really very anal retentive, as we would say, kind of people that were collectors. Freud, a lot of people have done work on this whole thing. There's a guy who just gave a speech of the, we didn't go, but last Friday at the Rubin Museum, they had a psychiatrist and a collector, and talking about what collecting meant, what being a collector meant.
Well, and we talk about in one of our final chapters about
Brundage?
No, not Brundage.
The
there were three Sackler brothers. All of them were psychiatrists. And the elder Sackler made a fortune in pharmaceuticals. You got a little memorandum from Mr. Sackler, Arthur Sackler, the senior, that he went into an antique store and he saw a piece of furniture and he didn't know what it was. And he took one look at it and he said, wow, that's something. What is it? And the owner of the antique store said, oh, that's Ming furniture. He said that was the moment, the eureka moment. And many of these same collectors have a eureka moment when they suddenly see something that is so speaks to them so eloquently that they have to learn more about it, and then they begin spending money on it.
I just had one little footnote because it reminded me. There was a man, the Nazi in the book. You know, everybody has to have one Nazi. every book. Edward von der Heydt, whose collection is the basis of the Rietberg Museum in Zurich. And he was the nuttiest collector of them all. He just had warehouses for his stuff, and at the time of, he was so worried at the outbreak of World War II, he was German, living in Switzerland, that he distributed his art in 26 different museums, I think it was, all over the world, including in Buffalo. Now, there's some wonderful stories about getting the stuff back from East Germany and all, but the Freer ended up with 13 pieces that they said, this guy is a war criminal, he's not getting it back. This was Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General then. But it's an interesting story about this guy who was so worried that it was going to be confiscated, he was going to lose it, that he took these precautions, and it didn't work.
Thank you.